I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yaman Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. Yaman started Patagonia in 1973, and the company exemplifies social and environmental responsibility. Some of its efforts include donating 1% of sales to environmental efforts, making its cotton sportswear 100% organic, having a childcare center on its premises, and reducing its energy use by 60%. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yaman is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about falconry because that really is the germ or the origination for Patagonia, ultimately, indirectly. Where did your interest in falconry come from when you were in your teens?
Well, I think it was just early teens, in fact. I don't know. I read a National Geographic article from a 1920 Geographic by the Frank and John Craighead about hawks and falcons, and I just got interested in it. And I got in with some other young fellows, and we started kind of a little club of falconers and would go around and climbing to hawks' nests and taking birds and training them, and then but also banding birds for the U.S. government and stuff.
Now, this was in Southern California?
That was in, yeah.
Your family lived in Maine before moving to Southern California. Why did they move?
Yeah, well, we moved when I was about 7 years old because my father had asthma, and my mother thought the climate would be better for him in California.
And for the first 7 years of your life, you went to a French-speaking Catholic school.
And
that's right. You spoke only French at home, too?
Yeah, this was in Lisbon, Maine, and everybody spoke French in Lisbon, Maine. They were all French-Canadians who came down from Canada to work in the woolen mills.
And when you moved to California and you started speaking English, do you remember that transition for you?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, as soon as we got to California, I was put in public school, and everybody, of course, spoke English. And I remember a few days later, I just ran away from school. That kind of set me on a different path the rest of my life.
Do you remember where you ran to?
No, I can't even remember that far back.
What are some other examples of your difficulty in adjusting?
Well, you know, in high school was a horror for me. I mean, you know, I had pimples. I was the shortest guy in school. I certainly didn't go to the prom, that's for sure. I was probably down in the bottom of the LA River gigging frogs and catching crawdads. And I mean, I've had a life in nature all my life, really. And it's saved my life.
Do you have any friends from your high school years or from your childhood? Or were you?
No.
What did your parents do?
My father was a tradesman. He could build an entire house by himself. He was a plumber, electrician, carpenter, mason, could do everything. Mm. Even though he only went to school till third grade, and that was it.
And how about you? When did you stop going to school?
I actually went to 2 years of college, in a junior college in California. At the time, I was working part-time as a private detective. My brother owned a private detective agency, and 18 years old, 19 years old, I was working as a private detective and going to school. But one day, I just was standing in line waiting to get my books for the next semester, and I just walked away, and it's the best thing I've ever done. I think I knew what I wanted to do, which was at that time I was doing a lot of climbing, and I wanted to make climbing equipment.
I want to dig into this private investigation, private detective work. What are some cases that you looked at?
Well, I was mainly working for Howard Hughes. This is when he was hiding out in a Beverly Hills hotel, and they were trying to subpoena him. And he had a whole bunch of so-called starlets all around town. And my job was to tail these starlets, and it's just all hanky-panky stuff.
And for those who don't know who Howard Hughes is, who is Howard Hughes?
Well, he was a Hollywood mogul. He was a pilot. He was quite a character. But in his later years, he was pretty crazy, and he did a lot of crazy things, and which required a lot of private detectives.
But your calling was in the wilderness.
Yeah, that's right.
We talk about falconry being the genesis of all this. What does falconry have to do with rock climbing?
Well, I learned to climb by climbing to falcons' eyries.
Eyries are the homes of falcons?
Yeah, that's the nest up on cliffs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned to climb, you know, using old manila ropes and not really knowing what we were doing, because there was no schools on climbing in those days. You had to learn the hard way, taking a lot of risk and barely coming out alive. Training falcons got me interested a lot in kind of Zen Buddhism philosophy. And my first lesson was basically trying to train a wild falcon. And you trap one and you put it on your fist and you put these jessies on his feet. And you try to stay up all night with him until he finally falls asleep. And that builds trust in the bird very quickly. But, you know, the Zen master's got to say, you know, who's getting trained here? You know, you got a 12-year-old kid having to stay up all night until this bird finally falls asleep.
So you developed this interest in rock climbing because you wanted to go to the nests of these falcons.
That's right.
At the time, this is in the late 40s, early 50s, there was no infrastructure for climbing. What equipment did you use?
Well, we used, in the beginning, we used, you know, Converse tennis shoes to climb in. There were no climbing shoes. Then we started getting some equipment from Europe, and specifically pitons, you know, the spikes that you drive into the rocks. And in those days, the pitons were made out of soft steel because the European attitude towards climbing was to conquer the mountains and make them easier for the next party. Hmm. You know, that's kind of the manifest destiny that created America, really. You know, tame the wilderness. But we were brought up with the philosophy of John Muir and Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, the American naturists who believed that you shouldn't alter nature. And just you should go into nature and leave no trace of having been there. So I wanted to make some pitons out of hard steel and so that you could use them over and over. And they worked really, really well.
And this was when you were roughly 19, 20 years old.
That's right.
You became essentially a blacksmith.
I borrowed some money from my folks and went out and bought an anvil and a coal-fired forge. And got some steel from the junkyard and pounded out my first pitons. And I used them for myself, and then friends wanted some, and then friends of friends. And then pretty soon, we were on the cutting edge of rock climbing, these huge walls in Yosemite, you know, that take 10 days. And in fact, you had to have my equipment if you were going to do that climb. You know, I've been a craftsman all my life, kind of, and I love working with my hands. And I love looking at a product and saying, you know, I can make that better. I'm not an inventor, but I'm an innovator.
You mentioned Yosemite. You also would hide out in Yosemite when you were overstaying your visit. What was that about?
Well, you're only allowed to in those days, I spent 2 weeks in Yosemite. Well, you can't do much climbing in 2 weeks. Some of those climbs we were doing would be on the wall for 10 days. And so, you know, we'd spend months there. So we were outlaws. We were basically hiding, living in the boulder fields. And
eating what?
Well, I remember 1958, I guess, I took off for the summer. And I stopped by this store in San Francisco that sold damaged cans. And I bought cases of damaged cat food and 10 cents a can. And, you know, I spent the summer eating porcupines and ground squirrels and whatever I could scavenge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we did.
So here you are. You're pioneering all this equipment for the rock climbing industry out of necessity. Where did it go from there?
Well, it turned into a business. I mean, and it wasn't just rock climbing equipment. I mean, we kind of reinvented all the ice climbing gear. In fact, the stuff was so advanced, so ahead of its time, that nobody even knew how to use it. So that was the first book I wrote. I had to write a book on how to ice climb, which kind of revolutionized ice climbing.
You were producing objects that literally supported your life, and mm-hmm. that requires a good deal of confidence. I would never trust myself mm-hmm. to build a device that really had my life in its hands. How did you feel about that?
Well, we were very careful, and at the time I had a partner, Tom Frost, and the two of us were designing and making this stuff. We were the only ones that did all the quality control and everything. I would take buckets of these pitons or carabiners or other tools at home and do all the inspection and quality control myself. And we had an attitude of making the absolute best climbing gear in the world. That was our philosophy.
And the name of your company was Chouinard Equipment.
That's right.
You were pioneering this equipment, but at the same time, you were harming the rocks, even though you were reusing the pitons.
Yeah. When I first started climbing, there was only maybe 250 serious climbers in America. But in the 70s, the sport kind of exploded, and more climbers doing the same routes over and over again, and they're putting in these hard steel pitons in the cracks and taking them out. And pretty soon we're realizing that it's leaving a big hole in the crack. So I felt that, okay, this is our fault. And so I felt, okay, since it's our fault, we need to be the ones to do something about it. And so we put at risk 80% of our sales in pitons and switched over almost overnight to a different method of protecting climbing by these little aluminum chocks that you put into the a constriction in the crack with your fingers, and you pull it out with your fingers, and it causes no harm whatsoever.
And when you're on these climbs, what part of your interest in climbing is the physical versus wanting some solitary moments?
Well, I don't think solitary has much to do with it, but I think the purpose of climbing is to affect some sort of spiritual or physical growth, and it has everything to do with how you get up there. Well, like if you climb in Yosemite, you get to the top of a 10-day climb, and there's nothing there. There's just the forest, and that kind of is the opposite of say some high-powered businessman paying $85,000 to be guided up Mount Everest. And what's important to him is to get to the top, not how you get to the top. And that's wrong. That's not what climbing is about.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. We'll hear more from Yvon coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yvon is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. What about the life of the mind? I mean, you were very active with your hands and climbing, mm-hmm. yet you didn't enjoy school at all. What did you do to exercise your brain's development?
Well, I've been a book reader all my life, and so for a couple of years there, I was drafted into the Army when I was 21, I think, and so I decided to read 100 books while I was in the Army.
By the way, what did your mother do? You mentioned what your dad did.
My mother was a housewife, but, my father was not an adventurer. My mother was the one that really wanted to travel and really wanted, she liked change. I'm much more like my mother than my father.
Except for the working with the hands component.
That's right.
So what happened to Chouinard Equipment, this company?
Well, eventually I sold it in the early 80s to the employees because I had started Patagonia, the clothing company, in 1973. And I was trying to run two companies. I couldn't do that. It was just too much. And now it's called Black Diamond. And they continue to make the best climbing gear in the world.
We mentioned before how Patagonia came from falconry. Falconry developed your interest in rock climbing. Mm-hmm. And then when you were rock climbing, you started wearing rugby shirts. And rugby shirt was really the germ of Patagonia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was on a climbing trip to Scotland in the winter. And I came back from the trip And I had bought a rugby shirt because I thought, hey, this is a cool shirt. And it's got a collar, so it worked really good for climbing because it was really tough material. The collar was protecting the gear sling from your neck. And it came in, you know, some bright colors and stuff. And at that time, men's sportswear had no color to it at all. All it was gray sweatshirts and sweatpants. That was it. And here I'm wearing this bright blue rugby shirt with the yellow and red stripes on it. And people were saying, wow, where'd you get that? And so the lights came on. I started importing a few. And they sold like crazy. And it started a whole fashion. That's how I got into the clothing business.
And why did you name it Patagonia?
Well, in 1968, I took a trip with my friend Doug Tompkins and three other guys.
He's the founder of North Face and Esprit.
We drove from California to the tip of South America. And I fell in love with that part of the world called Patagonia, the southern part of Argentina and Chile. And I wanted to start making clothing, and I thought Patagonia would be a good name because that's the kind of conditions I wanted to make clothing for. You know, ferocious winds and storms and these icy peaks, and I thought that would be a good name for a company.
You started the company in 1973. You were in your early 30s at the time. What was going on with your personal life?
When I was 32, I guess, I married my wife, Melinda, and she got involved in the business. And, you know, a few years later, we started having kids, and the company grew. And she is much more of a people person than I am. And she's been very good at HR problems. And she was responsible for starting a childcare center, which when we did that, you know, before we did that, we had employees coming to work with their kids in a cardboard box on their desk.
trying to hide the child.
Yeah, I mean, we've always operated like a different style business, like a family. So we wanted our family close to us. We didn't want to just leave home and leave the kids at home and drag ourselves back to work. And it turned out we had some screaming babies that were affecting everybody's work. So she thought, hey, it's a good idea to put in an on-site childcare center. And at that time, there was only 50 in the whole United States.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of the clothing company Patagonia. So we're talking about the early days. How did you finance the company initially?
Well, it was all we were self-financed, which works up to a point. The problem is we came out with a product that we call Cinchilla, which was a fleece. We were the first ones to come out with this. And when we did, it took off. And our growth, I mean, we were growing 50% a year. So we were growing 50% a year for several years, and you can't do that on retained earnings. You're gonna end up in financial problems. So we got in a really big financial trouble, and at the same time, there was a recession. And we had planned to do 50% that year. We bought the inventory, we hired the people, and we only grew 30%. We couldn't borrow any more from the bank. In fact, our bank was in financial trouble. In fact, my accountant introduced me to some mafia guys who wanted to lend me some money at 28% interest, which ironically is what people pay with their credit cards now. So anyway, I had to do a lot of soul searching. So I took about 10 of our top people down to Patagonia. We walked around for about 10 days and would walk for a while and then sit down and say, okay, what are we doing anyway? Why are we in business? None of us had a degree in business, not one person. We all had degrees in biology and English and sociology and anthropology. And you know, I had a degree from John Burroughs High School in auto mechanics.
Was that, by the way, on purpose, that none of your employees had any background in business?
Yeah, we didn't want to hire any greaseballs.
And so here you are financially strapped in a recession, and you say, how are we going to rectify the situation? Let's go to Patagonia.
Well, it's the best thing we ever did. Because, you know, we were able to write down why we were in business. The farmer has a responsibility to leave the farm in better shape than he received it. The forester has a responsibility to leave the forest, take a few trees out of the forest and not clear cut it and leave it in good shape. But somehow business is exempt from having any responsibility to do that. So we decided to put our business on a 100-year track, which means we had to control our growth to, you know, 5% or certainly less than 10% a year. So we don't artificially create a demand. We don't put ads on inner city buses to try to get the gang kids to wear our black down jackets rather than North Face. We keep trying to sell to people who need the product rather than want the product. And that got us out of this crazy growth that caused all our problems.
So you didn't have to raise any capital?
No, we didn't have to raise. Well, you know, I had to borrow money from friends and things like that. But I did have to lay off a bunch of employees that we had hired, which was something that I swore I would never do again.
How much capital did you put into the business initially?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It's year to year. I don't really know.
So are we talking like $300,000, $30,000, $3 million? You don't recall at all?
No, I really don't.
Even which decimal place were you?
No.
We talked about the recession, but what else was challenging for you?
Well, I still don't like the business part of it. The hardest part is finding the right people to work for you. If I'm interviewing somebody across the desk from me, I'm horrible at it because I believe everything they say. And so now when I interview somebody, I bring in a bunch of women who see right through everybody. They're much better at it than I am. I've made a lot of mistakes in hiring the wrong people.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about falconry, you alluded to Zen Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
What influence does that have on your outlook?
I mean, some people approach Zen Buddhism by meditating. I kind of approach it through action. And I've applied it in all my sports and applied it in business. Like, for instance, if you ask me what our profits were last year, I completely forgot. I have no idea what they were. I have no idea what they're going to be this year. I couldn't care less. I'm focused on the process. And if you're focused on the process of business, the profits come.
Now, for those who don't know about Zen Buddhism, what is like the central tenet of Zen Buddhism?
Well, I don't really know, actually. I wouldn't be able to answer that. And probably the Zen master would probably say the same thing. Well, you know, I mean, people say, okay, you've been a risk taker all your life. I don't take any risk at all. I do my homework. And if you do your homework, you don't take any risk. And like, for instance, I've been a whitewater kayaker and doing dangerous rivers, first descents of rivers and things like that. But the day I really learned how to kayak is I did a river next to my house in Wyoming. That is a difficult river, and it falls, you know, more than 100 feet a mile. And I did it one day without a paddle. If you don't have a paddle, you have to think way ahead. You have to be seated correctly in the seat. And you basically have to go down a river like a fish. And I did that, and I had a perfect run. And so people say, wow, that was a crazy thing to do. That was really risky. You know what? It wasn't risky. The worst that could have happened is I would have lost my boat and picked it up a few miles down, and I would have swam out. But by taking small risk, it gave me the confidence and the technique to not be so dependent on my paddle. And so then I went on and did lots of first descents of very dangerous rivers because of taking a small risk in the beginning. And so in business, that's how I operate my business. We take lots of small little so-called risks so that we don't take the big ones.
You do not use email, and you constantly lose your cell phone. I think you dropped it in the toilet or the river recently.
I actually hate all electronics. I don't even know how to turn on my television. And I think it goes back to when my father was an electrician. When I was a little kid, he'd say, hey, come on over here. And he'd stick his hand in an electrical outlet and then grab my hand and give me a shock, and he'd laugh. Ever since then, I've hated electronics. But yeah, I don't have a computer. I try to live a simple life. So I'm slowly getting rid of a lot of stuff.
A friend of yours said, behind every Luddite is a woman with a computer.
My wife is the most wired woman in America.
So what does cause you the most angst? If you're striving to get rid of so-called stuff, What provides you with the most anxiety?
Certainly, I feel guilty about flying all over the world and doing these sports. I mean, I'm certainly going to be in that seventh level of hell that's fueled with jet fuel. But I try, you know, not to fly first class or fly in private airplanes or any of that stuff, which is even worse.
So that's the stuff that burdens you.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. You made a switch to all organic cotton in the 1980s. And for thousands of years, farmers have been producing cotton organically. Why did farmers start using pesticides to grow cotton?
Well, it's not just cotton. Pesticides all started from World War II, pretty much. From a lot of the toxic things that they use in war. Yeah, before World War II, everything was pretty much organic. I mean, the lights came on for me one day when we put a store in Boston. We outfitted an old building and we redid it, and it was springtime. We brought in all our sportswear.
On Newberry Street?
Yeah, Newberry Street. And within a few days, our employees were complaining of getting headaches. So I brought in an environmental engineer, and he checked things out. He said, your ventilation system is recycling the same air, and you're poisoning your employees. I said, well, what are they getting poisoned with? Well, formaldehyde, he says. He says, it's all on that sportswear that you have out there, all that cotton clothing. I said, what? Then I find out that a label that says 100% pure cotton is, on the average, 73% cotton. The rest are chemicals put on the cotton afterwards to control shrinkage and pilling and wrinkling, stuff like that. The most common chemical is formaldehyde. You know, in biology class, you got a lizard in a jar, and that jar is filled with formaldehyde. It's really toxic, and we're all wearing it. Well, I said, I don't want to be in business if I have to use formaldehyde, which led us to realize that we didn't know what we were doing. We were just buying cloth and, already dyed and just making clothing. So that's when we decided to work on an environmental philosophy. And I gave the company 18 months to get out of that game, even though it was, 25% of our business. Well, that got everybody's attention. And I've never seen the business operate better. So, I mean, we had to go in partnership with some farmers and lend them money so that they could buy their seed, because the bank wouldn't lend them anything because the banks are in collusion with the chemical companies. And I mean, it was, and then, the spinner wouldn't spin our cloth because the cotton came in with seeds and stems and sticks, and it was sticky because of aphids, those little white bugs that you get on your garden, and it makes it real sticky. So the stuff was sticky, wouldn't go through the machines, and finally we found, one spinner in Thailand who developed a process of freezing the cotton before he put it in. And I mean, it was very, very difficult to pull it off, but we have not used 1 ounce of non-organic cotton since 1986.
What are some of the current initiatives going on in the industry?
We've been involved with a bunch of very large apparel companies and retail companies in creating a sustainability index for clothing. We have probably 60% of the apparel market in the world represented in this group of companies, and we're leading it. Our little company, Patagonia, is leading this, and what we're doing is going to end up where somebody can walk into a department store and there'll be 5 pairs of jeans, and they'll be able to zap their iPhone or whatever electronic thing they have onto the barcode, and it'll give a grade, and it'll tell you the whole history of that product. And you'll be able to make a decision as to which one of those 5 brands of jeans you want to buy, according to how responsibly they were made. That's a huge revolution.
Although, the word organic is so hackneyed these days, so you don't really know what organic means anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we want to do this ourselves. We don't want the government to do it. It's just like, I didn't wait for the Rangers in Yosemite to tell me to stop making hard steel pitons. We decided to do it ourselves. We think that we'll have much more stringent and more truthful index if we do it without the government.
you have a program called 1% for the Planet where you donate 1% of your sales or 10% of your profits, whichever mm-hmm. is greater. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, it usually ends up 1% of sales. We look at it as being a cost of doing business because we're polluters. There's no way you can make a product that's sustainable. There's no such thing as sustainability. We feel guilty about what we're doing, using up non-renewable resources and making, you know, a lot of sportswear and things like that. So we take that 1% and we give it to about 450 different environmental organizations.
And so what are sales roughly?
We're 350 million.
Okay, so that's about $3.5 million a year.
Yeah, we've given away about 40 million over the years.
Incidentally, can I see your hands for a second? They're well worn.
Oh, they're worn all right. My whole body's well worn. There's a lot of internal damage.
What occupies your time these days? You're not doing blacksmithing anymore.
I still do it, but I do it as a that's my sandbox.
So what do you make in your sandbox?
Oh, I make like the other day I made some crampons that you put on your feet for wading real slimy, rocky rivers. So it's a fishing product. And I made it in my blacksmith shop, and I was just in British Columbia testing it. And then I make, you know, I make hinges for houses. I make fireplace sets. I make all kinds of different things. But I have to work with my hands every day. And like I cook at home. If I've been pushing papers around all day, I have to go cut vegetables or do something. I have to do something on a daily basis.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
My guest has been Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. Coming up, we'll meet Andy Levine, co-founder of Six Men, a company that creates music cruise events. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.